case of the day, the estate of Nicholas Rice versus Correctional Medical Services. Mr. Desi?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michael Desi appearing on behalf of the estate of Nicholas Rice. Also with me at council table is Mr. Sean Drew, my brother counsel from Niles, Michigan. Your Honors, I represent the estate, as I mentioned, of Nicholas Rice, whose parents are also here present in the courtroom today, Ms. Diane Waldrop and Rick Rice. Your Honors, we're here in a 1983 civil rights case that involves the very tragic and sad death of a young man, Nicholas Rice, who died while in the custody of the Elkhart County Jail. And the Rice family retained us to pursue these constitutional claims, which were before the Honorable Judge Miller at the lower district court. And Judge Miller had granted summary judgment as to all of the estate's claims. Now, when we filed our complaint, we also had state law claims. And Judge Miller had declined to exercise a supplemental jurisdiction over those state law claims. And his reasoning for that was because he said those claims involved a different legal theory and whatnot. So he dismissed those claims. And after Judge Miller had granted summary judgment on the estate's constitutional claims, we refiled those state law claims in federal court under diversity jurisdiction. I'm just giving you the procedural posture of why there's two cases here today. Those state law claims under diversity were assigned to Judge Rudy Lozano, and Judge Lozano dismissed our state law claims under theory of collateral estoppel. So those two cases have now come up here. They're before Your Honors, and they've been consolidated. However, I'm only going to focus on Rice 1, as I call it, which are the constitutional claims before Judge Miller and the district court, because really the Rice 2 case is completely dependent on the outcome of Rice 1. So as this court is aware, that this court has examined many cases dealing with jail deaths, and there are several citations of case law as to the standards for that, and the standards of law, quite honestly, are very straightforward. And really, the court has the task of asking, did these defendants know that this individual, Nicholas Rice, was sick? And from those facts, or were they aware that they should have known that something bad was going to happen to him? Now, Nicholas was incarcerated at the jail for a period of 18 months, so this is a very massive record. It's extremely voluminous. There are hundreds and thousands of pages of medical reports, corrections reports. I'm sure Your Honor does know. I've been lugging them around with me myself. So what I'd like to focus on, though, are some very key factual dates, which I believe are the most important thing for this court's attention. And we'll start with Nicholas Rice going into the jail in September of 03. Okay. From that point forward until October of 04, there were all kinds of different things that were happening. Nicholas was just, he was completely filthy, he was soiling himself, he wasn't showering, he wasn't eating. He lost almost 50 pounds from the time that he had gone into the jail until the time that he'd come out. So between September and October of 04, we have all of these things, which hopefully those were adequately laid out in our briefs with citations to the record to make that easy for the court to find. Now, in October of 04, defendant Dr. Rohr says, this kid is dying and he needs help. And Dr. Rohr petitioned the court for emergency detention order. And at that point, Nicholas was taken to Goshen General Hospital. Well, Goshen was a defendant in this lawsuit. And Goshen General Hospital was dismissed, and Dr. Matthews was a defendant. And Dr. Matthews, when she discharged Nicholas in October, she said, he needs psychiatric care. He needs to be evaluated outpatient. I'm providing that he's medically stable at the moment, and he needs additional protein shakes and whatnot. But she said that that was just a temporary fix. Now, you can find those facts in Judge Miller's opinion. It's docket 280, and 280 is Judge Miller's opinion granting summary judgment to Goshen and to Dr. Matthews. What Dr. Matthews said is he needs psychiatric care and he needs to be evaluated. Well, let's now look and see what happened between October, when he came out of Goshen, and December, when he died. Well, the answer to that is really nothing happened. He was given some extra protein shakes. However, nothing changed with his psychiatric condition.
What did the estate's experts say in terms of what Dr. Rohrer should have done differently?
Well, the estate's experts concluded that, number one, Mr. Katsaris, who's a police procedures expert, said that Nicholas Rice should not have been housed, period, in this jail. He was not appropriate. His behavior and his mental illness was so severe that he should not have been housed at all in the jail. He should have been in a medical facility. Dr. Shiner indicated that had he been treated, the symptoms of his mental illness at least would have been under control, which could have prevented his death. Dr. Spitz, a forensic pathologist retained by the estate, also said his death was predictable and it was foreseeable given his untreated schizophrenia. The death certificate in the case lists his cause of death as schizophrenia. Now, the district court said, well, the defendants had no reason to know he was going to ingest large amounts of water. Psychogenic polydipsia is the name of that condition. Well, respectfully, I disagree with the district court's analysis, so narrow of an analysis as to causation. The question is not whether they knew he was going to ingest large amounts of water. The question was whether his mental illness was going to result in his demise or his exacerbated condition. Well, in this case, we know that the schizophrenia was causing all kinds of different issues. He wasn't eating. He was filthy. He was dirty. His cell was dirty. Other inmates had made the same observations, and they'd made those observations just as lay people. They said, hey, this kid is really sick. Just so the court's aware, there were about seven CDs, and these CDs are terribly, terribly sad. And if you haven't looked at them, I would ask that you take a look just to see. You can just see in an instant what Nicholas's condition was. He was completely unable to care for himself. He was unable to do anything. He was literally just at the whims of day to day. Now, Dr. Rohr, during his deposition, he was asked the question, did you know that he was going to die? Dr. Rohr said, yes, I knew. And we asked him, we said, well, could it be October? Could it be November? Could it be December? He said, yeah.
You know, with respect to the conditions of confinement claim, what is it that you believe the jail staff specifically should have done? Cleared out of his cell every day, showered him against his will every day? Spell it out, please.
Your Honor, you're just referring only to the conditions of confinement claim. Well, if the other inmates, yeah, the other inmates were indicating that it was just filthy and it smelled so horrible that they didn't. One inmate assaulted him. So, for one easy fix would have been just to clean the cell. How about remove the food? There was feces. There was urine. I mean, this was really. Forgive me. I don't want to be overly dramatic, but it was so disgusting that the idea of it to most of us, if you saw it or smelled this, it would just be repulsive. Well, the other inmates were complaining and said, hey, he smells so bad, I don't even want to be near him, which also resulted in him being assaulted. Now,
talk about the other inmates. There were some affidavits of some inmates that were not considered.
Sure.
What was the so important about that, and why wasn't it, I guess the names were not disclosed in the timely fashion, but maybe
sure.
The other side knew who they were anyhow. I don't know.
Right. I briefed the issue, and I indicate in our brief that we received the names of those inmates from the defendant's own discovery, and I've cited to the actual document. I looked at it again this morning. I think it's called the JCA notes or something that it lists the inmates. That's where we obtained the names of these inmates, and we're talking about Niece, Brown, Joshua Shaw, and there's another name that escapes me at the moment.
But now, are you arguing that those affidavits were properly disclosed?
Well,
surely you're not.
Well, we believe that that would fall under Rule 26E, which says that if the information is otherwise known to the party, then they don't need to be stricken, or they shouldn't be stricken. Now, here's the argument I'm making, Your Honor. They had the name of Joshua Shaw, who was disclosed. Now, the defendants didn't take Mr. Shaw's deposition. So they've now complained that, hey, this was surprise. We would have taken the depositions or we could have asked these people. Well, they did have Joshua Shaw's name, and they didn't take his deposition. So,
okay, how did they have Joshua Shaw's name?
His name was disclosed. His affidavit was not stricken, Your Honor. I think we're talking about four affidavits, only three of which were stricken. Mm-hmm. Joshua Shaw's affidavit is still in there. But, Your Honor, to answer your question about the importance of these, it's not important. It's not a make or break deal of those affidavits. It only shows you that these were lay witnesses in the jail setting who were in this environment and who said, hey, we saw this kid every day. He was so sick. He was out of his mind. He smelled. He was filthy. He was covered in feces. And they were there on the night of his death, and they heard what was going on, including Joshua Shaw, whose affidavit is part of the record. Now, they said, we were banging on the cell doors. We were kicking our cell doors. They call it mule kicking, where they use their feet. They kick the doors. And they were trying to get the attention of the jail staff. They said, hey, something is wrong with this kid. Nobody came into the jail cell. So those affidavits just go to show you what happened on the night in question. Now, I don't believe those affidavits, they don't carry the day. There's enough evidence in this record that creates questions of fact as to our claims, even without the inmate affidavits. However, Joshua Shaw's affidavit is part of the record, and his affidavit alone creates the same question of fact. They all say something a little bit differently. As Your Honor pointed out about the conditions of confinement claim, we actually have several different claims in the case. There's the conditions of confinement, the excessive force, and on that claim I'm talking about the two occasions in which Nicholas was put into a restraint chair for 18 hours. He was put into a chair, shackled for 18 hours.
But he wouldn't get out.
Well,
he would not get out. He would try.
Well, the district court said he wouldn't.
That's certainly not your strong.
No, I agree it's not. I just want to make clear that we have several claims. The strongest claim is the deliberate indifference to his medical needs, which eventually resulted in his death. However, I also want to make clear that his death was just another part of the damages in the case. All of his symptoms and his treatment and his condition over all of those months is still part of our deliberate indifference claim.
So how are you going to, I know how I would, but I want to know how you would discuss Ibsy versus Clark.
Ibsy versus Clark, that's referring to...
If an inmate is the cause of the unsanitary conditions, he may not be able to challenge the conditions as inhumane.
Oh, I understand, Your Honor, and that refers to the conditions of confinement claim. I believe that the distinction here is that Nicholas Rice, this wasn't somebody who was doing, Nicholas wasn't doing these things in order to cause a disruption or to basically be rebellious. He was doing these things because of his mental illness. I think that the case that makes more sense of this is Freeman versus Burge, in which Judge Posner of this court wrote, if somebody is this sick, we cannot let an inmate who's this sick not receive the type of treatment or let them starve themselves to death because of the disruptions that it causes in the jail condition. So I believe this is a little different in the sense that Nicholas's environment and all of these symptoms, they were caused by his untreated schizophrenia. As opposed to just...
And Ibsy was not mentally ill.
I don't believe that was the distinguishing factor, Your Honor. I don't believe so, but I couldn't say for 100% certainty.
Did he have... I assume he had a lawyer during all of this time. Well, he was in custody of 18 months. He was found not competent to stand trial.
Yes.
And he has a lawyer. Was there ever any... motion to the judge who had his case or anything like that to suggest, yeah, we got to get this guy out of the jail into some hospital or something?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, thank you. I'm glad that you asked that question. Document 217-10. This is an order from the Elkhart County, the state court, circuit court, and this is where Nicholas's attorney, this was Brent Zook, and the prosecutor went into court and signed an order saying that he would there be there from that point be committed to the Division of Mental Health. So it was December 5th of 2004 that the court, or excuse me, December 6th, 2004. 2004. This is there was a competency hearing, Your Honor. Yes, in 2003, but I'm referring
he
now.
He died in December of 2004.
Yes, on December 17th. But this is one of the other facts I wanted to bring to your attention this morning. December 6th of 2004, the judge from the underlying criminal case signed an order to put him in a mental health facility on December 6th. Nothing happened between December 6th and December 17th. If just this one order would have been followed, his death would have been prevented. If just this order alone would have been followed, it was signed by Judge Shoemaker on December 6th saying, okay, we're going to get this kid out finally into a facility. And this is after Dr. Rohr had said, hey, this kid is dying. Dr. Matthews had said, this kid needs psychiatric treatment. And nothing was done. Now, I want to also address briefly the state actor argument as to Dr. Sinisteros. Judge Miller said, well, Dr. Sinisteros isn't a state actor, so therefore he's out. Well, Dr. Sinisteros was the Oak Lawn physician who refused his admission. And he did that based on his prior examinations, his prior dealings of Nicholas. So it really seems a little circular to me that Dr. Sinisteros, because this is what we essentially have. The sheriff's defendant said, well, we relied on CMS. And we thought CMS was going to take care of it. CMS said, well, we relied on the Oak Lawn physicians. Well, then the Oak Lawn physician who ultimately had the responsibility, Dr. Sinisteros, said, well, I'm not admitting him, and he's not a state actor. That's a circle. Do you see how that circle, if each person points the finger to the next group?
Yeah, and then but you know something? The patient in this case was a pretrial detainee, and the hospital physician, Cisneros, had a contract with the jail. But there are cases, holding that the professional staff at private hospitals normally don't become state actors simply because the patient, is committed involuntarily. I have to be honest, that's the point I'm having the hardest time sorting out.
I agree with Your Honor. I agree with the point you just made, and I'll explain how the best way to describe that. If I'm at home and my family member or someone in my family needs a psychiatric admission, and I go get an order, and that my family member just gets taken to a hospital, does that doctor become a state actor? No. No, I agree with that proposition, but that's not what has happened here. He was taken to Oak Lawn because Oak Lawn had the contract to treat him. Oak Lawn was receiving money from the state, essentially, it's through a series of contracts, for the treatment, the psychiatric treatment of the inmates. So this isn't the situation of someone on the street out here who just all of a sudden gets committed to a hospital and then wants to sue that doctor in federal court alleging a 1983 violation. The doctor says, well, wait a minute, I was just at the hospital, they brought him in here and I looked at him. That's a completely different scenario.
Before you sit down, I just want to focus for a moment on the conditions of confinement. You spoke of Mr. Rice's attorney obtaining an order on what date?
December 6th of 2004.
What kind of contact was there between either family or attorney during this periods of confinement?
Well, my understanding is that the family that Nicholas had even refused on occasion to see his family members. I don't know how many times Mr. Zook, who was Nicholas's criminal attorney, I don't know how many visits.
I'm just trying to find out if we can fix a point in time when Mr. Zook was alerted to what he believed were conditions which would suggest going to court for the transfer.
Well, I don't know of a date other than, like I said, document 217-10 gives us the actual order. I believe that the sheriff's department...
David, do we from the attorney?
I don't believe we do have an affidavit on that. What I believe happened, I don't know, but I believe the sheriff's office said, listen, we can't have this kid here anymore. Somebody has to do something. He's just completely sick. He's making a mess of things of himself. He's not taking care of himself.
What is our record on the frequency with which the area of confinement was cleaned?
I don't believe there's any indication in the record as to when it was cleaned.
No inquiry was made as to just the routine of any cell, much less this particular cell?
I guess I'm told by my brother counsel it's in the videos.
In
the dates of the cleanings of the cell, because some of those were videotaped. But other than that, I don't believe there's a charted record that says his cell was cleaned.
The charge is that they were in attendance, certainly. The jail, the custodians were in attendance to the cleanliness issue. So I'm just trying to see what was before Judge Miller on that specific issue of the conditions you described.
Oh, I understand. There was the affidavits of the inmates. That would be one thing that just described the conditions. Other than that, the videotapes were also before Judge Miller. Those were part of the summary judgment record.
Are those videos described those to me? I have not seen those.
There are several videos. They show when Nicholas was showered or when he received a haircut. And in some of these, he literally just is standing catatonic without any movement. They have to pick him up.
Speak to his condition versus the proximity, the area around him?
By both. There's seven videos, all of which are part of the summary judgment record. Just to cite the court's attention, Gillis v. Litcher is a case that we cite in our brief that says that if there are competing inferences as to those conditions of confinement, that is a jury question. That was decided by this court in 2006.
All right. I know you used up your time, but we'll give you a little time for a rebuttal.
Okay. Actually, I had reserved 5 minutes.
Yeah, but you
used it. We will.
Okay. Thank you. I always have a problem of talking too much. Thank you.
That's fine. We asked a fair number of questions. Mr. Jensen.
Good morning. I represent physician defendants, Dr. Cisneros, Dr. Rohr, and Oak Lawn. Let me talk first of all about Dr. Cisneros. Dr. Cisneros' contact with the individual was as a result of two applications that were filed for emergency detention. Those examinations took place pursuant to Indiana statute to make a determination as to whether or not there was probable cause for involuntary commitment.
So does the fact that Mr. Rice was a pretrial detainee matter at all in terms of whether Dr. Cisneros was a state actor? I mean, you heard me. This is the
point. Yes, I understand that. The district court said he was not. And the reason the district court said that is that if you look at the public function test, evaluation of individuals pursuant to state statute to determine whether or not they have a mental problem that warrants involuntary confinement is not a function that is exclusively the role of the government. Then the question becomes, because he is a pretrial detainee, under the West analysis, does that somehow or another change that? In other words, does the status of this individual as a pretrial detainee sort of transform every otherwise private actor who sees him into a state actor because of West? That's the problem that the district court grappled with, and the district court concluded that was not the case. Now, there are some other cases that are out there that basically say you have to parse the relationship. Now, it's important in this case to realize that there was a contract between Oak Lawn and CMS for the provision of medical and mental health care services. But the contract was specific to providing Dr. Rohr as the individual who would provide those services. And his name is specifically enumerated in the contract, his hourly billing rate, and the terms and conditions in which he's going to provide the service.
Okay, but with respect to Dr. Rohr, why isn't there a question of fact as to whether he was deliberately indifferent?
Well,
Mr. Rice was exhibiting a pretty discernible decline here. He's not eating. He's losing weight. He's not caring for himself. He's living in beyond filth. And yet the doctor doesn't intervene by seeking to forcibly medicate him.
Okay, that is inaccurate. Let me tell you why. Dr. Rohr filed three applications for emergency detention. The first one he filed was October 28th, 2003, after he was advised in early October that the patient was no longer taking a Seroquel. Remember, he comes into the institution on September 3rd.
Yeah, well, there are significant gaps of time, sir, when 2 to 3 months, when he was not seen by any physician.
No, I think you've got 15 times, and the plaintiffs tell us in their brief, the appellants tell us, he was seen regularly by Dr. Rohr. Now, there were times when he wouldn't see Dr. Rohr, and so Dr. Rohr had to check on his condition for other reasons. But you have the emergency detention, application for emergency detention to get someone else to review the status of the patient. That takes place on 28 October 2003. Then there is a competency evaluation by Drs. Rutt and Cisneros in December of 2003. Then in May 2004, Rohr files yet another emergency detention application. And there is yet another review by a physician in an inpatient facility with regard to making a determination of whether there's probable cause to hold him.
Are you arguing that Dr. Rohr stepped in and sought forced medication, for example, to help?
The first step under the state of Indiana is exactly what he did. The emergency application is the first step. Involuntary commitment follows, and in the involuntary commitment context, that is where the forced medication could be. Yes, that's what he did.
Did he seek forced medication?
He had somebody more knowledgeable than him review, evaluate, and examine the patient on two separate occasions to determine whether involuntary commitment was called for. And if there was probable cause for involuntary commitment under the Indiana statutes, that triggers then the 72-hour detention and the whole panoply of rights that a patient has with regard to whether or not he's going to take the forced medication. That's exactly what Dr. Rohr did. No case I can find shows a deliberate indifference where the physician who is seeing the patient is actually trying to trigger the use of the statute which gives rise to the right of the state to force medicate him.
So there's absolutely no fact question in your mind as to whether he was deliberately indifferent to the medical condition?
Absolutely not. I don't think you can find another case in which the physician was actively engaged in this process. He does it again in October of 2004. He files another application for emergency detention. And the patient, instead of going to Elkhart General Hospital, is taken to the Goshen General Hospital, again for purposes of evaluation of patient's condition. And then on December 3rd, 2004, the patient is ordered transferred to Logansport. So there are multiple occasions in which Dr. Rohr is the initiating physician to do the things under the Indiana statute that allows somebody to be forced medicated.
So I'm off the wall when I say that there were 2 to 3 months at a time when he was not seen by any physician.
He was seen by Dr. Rohr.
No, just answer my question, please, sir.
There were a couple of occasions when he would not see the patient.
Were
the doctor.
There 2 to 3 months at a time when no physician saw him? Just say yes or no.
On a couple of occasions.
Thank you.
So the question, and that was only because he wouldn't see Dr. Rohr. He refused to see Dr. Rohr. He refused to take his medication. He made it abundantly clear when he was an inpatient that he would not take his medication. But his affect, the way he appeared, and all of the examination disclosed that he was able, he was alert, he was cooperative, and his mental status was not something that showed that he was acting in a fashion that would require involuntary commitment, because he did not appear to be dangerous. Dangerous defined as dangerous to himself or dangerous
and
to
what,
others.
What does catatonic, the fact that he's catatonic, how does that factor into your argument?
When he was an inpatient, he was not catatonic. When he knew he was going to be returned to the jail, he would act catatonic. Now, that was the problem that confronted Dr. Cisneros on two such occasions. And you will see in the Yoder affidavit and report, he was a court-appointed psychologist who examined the patient in conjunction with the June 2004 competency. He specifically says there's a question about whether or not his catatonic state might be faked. So the physicians had to weigh all of these different things together to make a determination as to whether or not there should be an involuntary commitment. Because he behaved in a different fashion, Judge Rovner, according to the undisputed evidence, when he was being examined as an outpatient, as opposed to the way he behaved when he was in jail. And so that question, as far as the judge was concerned, was a question of judgment with regard
so
to how to...
So in your view, he was not mentally ill?
No. He clearly carried a diagnosis by everybody who took care of him of schizophrenia. There is no doubt about that. The problem is, how do you treat the schizophrenic who doesn't want to be treated? And did Dr. Rohr, was he deliberately indifferent when he took the steps that he did to get additional assistance to see whether or not the patient should be in an environment which would force medication? My time is up. Yes, sir.
My time is up, but I just have a short inquiry with regard to Dr. Cisneros.
Yes.
And the issue of state actor.
Yes, sir.
Is it clear that Dr. Cisneros entered into the relationship with Rice on a voluntary basis?
Yes, sir. This was pursuant to the application that was filed with the state court for the emergency detention. So it's pursuant to Indiana state law, which is how the judge in this case distinguished it from the West situation in which the physician might otherwise be liable as a state actor. In these situations, the distinction was that he entered into that relationship pursuant to Indiana statute in order to fulfill a statutory obligation because of the court order.
Of course, his employer, Dr. Cisneros' employer, did have the contract with the state, right?
The state, that's correct. But as far as the judge below was concerned, that was not determinative.
Well, I appreciate that, and I respect the judge below greatly, but is that so clear, I guess?
This was an individual who was, remember, under the application, and you'll see the forms, you have to be in a facility. And the facility in which he was Oak Lawn. Then, that's as a result of Dr. Rohr.
Right.
Then there is an order for a physician to see that individual, and it was Dr. Cisneros who saw him at Oak Lawn.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Brennan?
May it please the court. My name is Michael B. Brennan. I represent Correctional Medical Services, also known as CMS, and its employees. We respectfully submit 4 points for Your Honor's consideration. First, the district court in Rice 1 correctly concluded that the CMS defendants were not deliberately indifferent to Mr. Rice's mental health and medical needs. Second, the district court in Rice 2 properly concluded that issue preclusion applies to foreseeability, an essential element of the estate's claims in Rice 2. Third, there is no proper corporate liability claim under the Monell decision in Rice 1. And fourth, the district court in Rice 1 did not abuse its discretion by striking the 3 late inmate affidavits. With regard to those late inmate affidavits, Judge Evans, Rule 26A provides, of course, that there must be a preliminary disclosure that those of the names of the individuals involved. These names were on one sheet of paper that were part of 20,000 pages of documents that were produced throughout the case. The circumstance was such that the names had to be listed, otherwise they could not be used, and Judge Miller made a discretionary determination with regard to that.
It is pretty common, I would think, that the jail has more information about who was in cells close to this fellow during the period of time that he was there, and that you already knew or should have known who these people were and could have got affidavits from them yourself. And I don't know. Maybe it doesn't. It's not a make or break issue in the case, I suppose. But I don't know. I think I might have been tempted to consider those, or
I think given the scope
time to take their depositions or something, and then consider as part of the whole package here.
I think given the scope of the record, it was an instance where the names themselves were important. Otherwise, one would be prophylactically deposing everybody listed in the discovery. That's why Joshua Shaw's name, for example, which was part of the preliminary disclosure, that affidavit was not stricken. The other three, which were filed late, 2 months after the summary judgment motion was filed, those did ultimately get stricken.
But the guy whose affidavit was accepted wasn't deposed anyhow, so...
That's correct, and also Judge Miller, in his footnote 4 on page 11 of his opinion, makes it quite clear that that affidavit's of only very limited utility to him, especially with regard to any dispute with regard to what our client, CMS, and its employees did.
Could we talk, please, about Nurse Lambert? She was on duty the night that Mr. Rice died. Did policy require her to conduct hourly checks of the administrative unit, or did that only apply to the guards? And was there any evidence that she would have heard the other inmates kicking their doors?
On the latter question, no, I'm not aware of any. On the former question, with regard to the policy, the CMS policy, I believe it was once per shift, but the determination was made for that to be done more often, which was
No. See, what I'm trying to get at is if policy requires Nurse Lambert to check the cell every, hour on that administrative unit, or is it just the guards that have to do that?
I am not aware of any policy that would require Nurse Lambert to give that type of checking. Once Mr. Rice got to the administrative segregation unit after October 5th of 2004 until his death on December 18th, in that time frame he was being seen frequently, in excess of 200 times.
Well, that's what you say, but they say something. You know, we've got a lot of apples and oranges going on here that, might be fact questions.
I think on the two most important areas, Your Honor, there is not. First, there's no conflicting evidence of the cause of death. Hyponatremia as a result of the...
Well, not on that death certificate. Schizophrenia is on that death certificate.
Correct. However, if one were to utilize schizophrenia as the cause of death, one would potentially make the jails or its the individual companies with whom the jails contract, like CMS, insurers for all individuals, prisoners with mental health. I don't think the equation can be mental health plus incident equals liability. I think if we get to that point, we've gone far afield from what deliberate indifference is about. Rather, here we have to look at the complete record. Many of the incidents that have been mentioned by the state here predate that October 5th, 2004 timeframe, which is an important one because at that point he's declared medically stable. There's some mild dehydration, but the description from the estate is one of a downward spiral. But I think the entire record over the course of the 15 months is much more likely one of stasis, especially after October 5th of 2004. When that December 6th order comes down, it becomes clear that Mr. Rice is in a even better position than he was before. He takes a shower 3 days before he has to leave. He's seen running around the ward. There is a circumstance that makes it just unforeseeable that this type of death, hyponatremia as a result of water intoxication, would be anticipated or foreseen by the individuals involved. Remember that the...
What if he would have hung himself? Would that be a different case?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, in this sense, that there was just no predictive nature of any of the previous acts. Even, of course, the August 2nd razor incident was not a suicide. Estate's expert, Dr. Burns, indicated it wasn't. Mr. Rice indicated it wasn't. The investigation, Sharon Jones, one of the individual CMS defendants, investigated, determined it was not, and her supervisor, Ms. Hess, did as well. So without any indication to have any foreseeability, there wouldn't be a basis to conclude that. Here we don't have a suicide circumstance. We have this schizophrenia with a variety of sequelae. Not even the estate's experts indicate that one of the top consequences of schizophrenia is hyponatremia with a resulting water intoxication, as a result of water intoxication. Given that lack of foreseeability, the concern with Mr. Rice, of course, was underconsumption of food rather than overconsumption of water. And I think it's a hard case to put, even if there had been some issues with regard to his overconsumption of liquids, how that would have been handled. We know at least that that wasn't on individuals' minds, nor should it have been, as a result of the records before the court. It's one much more one of underconsumption rather than overconsumption. Unless there are further questions for the court, we'll rest. Thank you.
Mr. Brennan, Mr. Jordan.
Pull up a chair.
It's on the your side. Where...
Thank you. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
May it please the court. My name is Nathaniel Jordan, and I represent the Sheriff's Department defendants. Not every inmate death gives rise to a Section 1983 claim, and the question is not whether everything that possibly could have been done was done.
Yeah, but if we accept the estate's version of events, why isn't there a question of fact as to whether the officers who were on duty that night were deliberately indifferent? If the officers didn't conduct their hourly checks, and there's, you know, a lot of argument about that, and the inmates are mule-kicking their cell doors, as Mr. Shaw states, isn't that evidence of deliberate indifference?
It's not, and there's no dispute of fact on the important issues here. With respect to the checking of the cells on an hourly basis, the Seventh Circuit decision in State Bank of St. Charles versus Kamek shows another situation where officers weren't aware of a condition that an inmate might have and weren't found liable for not following the policy.
Look, the inmates are kicking their doors to try and get attention. How are the inmates supposed to communicate the medical nature of the problem here if no one is responding to them?
The officers that are named in this lawsuit, there's no evidence submitted by any of the affidavits, even the ones that were stricken, that any officer defendants were aware that there was any kicking taking place. Even if there was evidence they had heard any kicking, and there's not, there's no evidence that they would have known that had to do with Nicholas Rice.
But it's a question of fact. You say they didn't. They say they did.
For purposes of summary judgment, we are going with Joshua Shaw's affidavit. For purposes of summary judgment, we submit that Joshua Shaw has said no officers came to the ward that night. So we don't dispute that for summary judgment purposes.
So then what's the purpose of the policy requiring our hourly checks of this administrative unit if not to prevent the very sort of thing that happened here?
There are a lot of reasons for a policy like that, and checking on inmates is one of them. But there's no connection to any of the officers that have been sued in this case to say that they were deliberately indifferent to Nicholas Rice that evening. There's no evidence that they heard any of the pounding. The two officers that were in the...
What's the evidence that they didn't hear it? What's the evidence that they didn't hear it? It's a fact question.
Well, with respect to the factual issue, we believe that summary judgment was properly granted. As Judge Miller granted summary judgment, he properly granted it, taking what Joshua Shaw said as true. And so even with Joshua Shaw's allegations being true, that he was kicking through the night on his cell door, as a matter of law, summary judgment must still be granted in favor of the Sheriff's Department defendants. And in fact, the two officers that were closest to that ward that night were in the first floor control room, and those were both dismissed by the estate voluntarily in 2008. For the Sheriff's Department for there to be an official capacity claim against the Sheriff's Department, there must be a showing of an unconstitutional policy, procedure, or practice, and that amounts to deliberate indifference and is actually the moving force. Nicholas Rice came to the Elkhart County Jail on September 8, 2003, and was there for 15 months until December 18 of 2004. During that time, he was held there on a bench warrant out of Elkhart Circuit Court for attempted robbery, a Class C felony, and he had a bond that was ultimately reduced to $15,000. On June 10 of 2004, there was an adversarial competency hearing held with Nicholas and his defender and prosecutors present, and Judge Shoemaker found Nicholas competent to stand trial and then set a December 6 hearing for trial. On December 2, there was a new prosecutor that had not previously appeared on the case, and she agreed with the public defender that Nicholas lacked the capacity to stand trial. Judge Shoemaker entered that as an order on December 6, and he then waited until receiving a confinement authority from the Division of Mental Health and Addiction of the Indiana Department of Family and Social Services. That came in on December 20th, 2 days after.
Talk about the conditions of confinement.
Yes.
Judge Miller said Mr. Rice was responsible for the condition of his cell. But Mr. Rice, we all agree, everyone in this courtroom now agrees that Mr. Rice was mentally ill. And at the very least, the fact finder might have found that he wasn't responsible for his actions. So in that sense, weren't jail officials responsible for the unsanitary conditions?
The Sheriff's Department is responsible to provide adequate medical care and conditions in the jail. And when they saw somebody like Nicholas Rice, who wasn't at times able to accommodate his own hygiene, they started to arrange showerings, haircuts, nail clippings. He was moved to the administrative ward in May of 2004, and at that time...
Was his cell as, you know, repulsive as everyone maintains here?
Well...
I mean, as the estate maintains here?
With respect to what the estate has filed, we're not making a dispute of fact about that. And there were times that the cell did get very dirty. And that's why the Sheriff's Department, beginning in the spring of 2004, started talking about cleaning his cell, about showering Nicholas.
Started talking about?
It was
about doing? The guy's covered in feces, urine, old food.
He was in the medical ward and for a period of 4 months until May of 2004 during the winter. And before that time, he had been showering himself to some degree, and that's noted in 2003. Then he goes to the medical ward, where there's not a record of whether he did or didn't shower. But in May of 2004, he comes to the administrative cell that's in direct line of sight of the control room. And at that point, it's in early June 6th, that the officers start to clean his cell and have inmates clean his cell. That happens in June a couple of times. And then in August, they begin showering. There's actually a note about the August showers that the warden says it's time for Nicholas to receive another shower. So it's not clear if he would have received them from officers before then. But from August forward, he receives them on a regular basis. His cell is clean on a regular basis. There are six total showerings we have record of in August, September, October, November, and December. And he did have moments of lucidity. 3 days before his death, he did take a shower on his own.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Mr. Desi, you may have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sure Judge Fahm will give you more time in addition to your 2 minutes just to answer this question. Factually, as I understand, he was in custody in Michigan for a little while and then was brought to the Elkhart County Jail. Was there a time when he could have been bailed out of the jail?
Bailed out?
Yeah, was bail set for him?
I don't believe so. I believe bail was denied, which was
my question.
In Elkhart. Correct.
He was held without bond.
I believe so.
No?
Yeah.
$10,000.
Oh, excuse me. I stand corrected. He was subject to a $10,000 bond.
So a $1,000 bail bond would have got him out of jail?
That's correct.
Probably. Is there any evidence that anybody, parents, friends, family, anybody, tried to bail him out of jail?
At the time, his condition was unknown, and no, they did not. There was no attempt to bail him out.
Were they not visiting him at all?
I believe there were visitations once he was in the jail for several months. My understanding is, and some of the visitations were denied or declined by Nicholas.
Your Honors, I want to make a point about the Dr. Sinisteros and the dispute about the state actor and Dr. Rohr's opinions. This court decided a case, actually, in which Judge Rovner wrote the opinion Walker versus Benjamin, a 2002 case. And actually, that case says that even if the doctor had a good faith belief that somebody was malingering, there's still a question of fact because of the subjective nature of the conditions. Barry versus Peterman more recently referred and cited Walker v. Benjamin for the same position, which is if there are disputes between the physicians, that's a question of fact. In this case, we have Dr. Rohr giving one opinion, Dr. Matthews giving one opinion, Dr. Sinisteros saying I'm not going to admit him. And as to Judge Flom's question, I believe, about whether Nicholas was voluntarily seen by Dr. Sinisteros, I'm not sure I understood your question, but I think
he's compelled to by the contract. Not, in other words, we've made these distinctions.
Right. Okay. Well, certainly Nicholas didn't. He didn't have the choice of where he was going to be treated. Now, the series of contracts were that CMS was for the medical, and then that they contracted Oak Lawn for psychiatric. Now, I heard something new today that I didn't really know before, which my brother counsel said, well, it wasn't Dr. Sinisteros, it was only Dr. Rohr. I didn't know that. Well, why did Dr. Sinisteros see Nicholas on two prior occasions then, when he refused to admit him or only held him at the Oak Lawn facility for something like 24 hours? So, this was news to me, what I heard from my brother counsel, that Dr. Sinisteros wasn't really the one who's responsible. I know Oak Lawn was paid because there are documents in the file that show that they had to receive approval from CMS. CMS had to have the approval to pay Oak Lawn. So when Dr. Sinisteros saw Nicholas in May of 2004, that was pursuant to the contract. That was the emergency detention order. Again, then in October of 2004, when Dr. Rohr said, this kid's dying, we need to put him somewhere. And that's when Dr. Sinisteros said, well, I'm not taking him. Now, Dr. Sinisteros disputes that conversation happened with Dr. Matthews, and she wrote it down and said, well, Dr. Sinisteros is refusing to take him. So the point is, somebody should have, Dr. Rohr, or somebody should have said, well, then we'll take him somewhere else, which is what Judge Shoemaker eventually said in December. And from December 6th, when that order was signed, he doesn't get sent anywhere. And then he dies on December 17th.
Does the record reflect anything, Mr. Desi, on prior treatment for Mr. Rice? This is in advance of his incarceration on the charges. What do we have of the mental history prior to this?
The record reflects, this is page 3 of my brief, that he had been diagnosed in his senior year of high school, that he commenced mental health treatments through various medical providers, and he received a diagnosis of schizophrenia.
Well, I appreciate it, but were there any? Do we have any like medical records? I understand what you have in the brief, but what will the record tell us about what was available to the physicians?
Sure. After, as Your Honors mentioned, he was in Michigan before. He was at the Berrien County Jail. From there, he ended up going to the Lakeland Hospital, St. Joseph. Then he was sent to University of Michigan. The University of Michigan, that was for psychiatry. Now, those records were all available. They were in there. And from there, he was then sent to the Kalamazoo Psychiatric Hospital. Those Kalamazoo records were viewed by the defendants, and they had acknowledged that, and that's cited in our brief also, that they had acknowledged seeing those records. So those were records before he came into Elkhart, and they had seen those Kalamazoo records.
Your quote of Walker and Benjamin is accurate in that issue of an assessment of malingering can be a jury question, a fact question. But I want you to give me your best argument on Dr. Cisneros being a state actor.
Okay, Nicholas Rice didn't have the choice of who he could see, and he was seen by the person who had the contract to treat him for psychiatric services. And I believe that's consistent with West v. Adkins, as well as other circuits that have extended that to the same situation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Desi.
Thank you,
Thank you to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a 5-minute recess.